All right, here we go.
Welcome to the CEN Show, the voice of the world community. The Community Education Network is a community of educators bringing forth grassroots information. Our motto is each one teach one. And every guest is providing with us sacred information, which is coined by our distinguished professor, Amin Ra. I am your host, Roski Mascani. On March 9th, 2022, Sandra Rogers was our guest, and every time she attends, a crowd follows. Yes, Sandra brings the people out.
I
was trying to get together. I was trying to find.
Where are you, Sandra? I can't see you.
Okay, so let's continue, folks. We didn't start it. I know this when Sandra come and Kelly, Lisa come, it's a party. So we're gonna have a good time. All right. So now on that show, we had Miss Lisa's daughter, which is Alexis. And Alexis, she started speaking. And at the end of the show, I said, Alexis, would you like to be a guest? Because I had to get her on. She had a lot of information she was bringing to us. So she agreed, and that was excellent. So now, when she agreed to come on, she also is bringing on her friend, Charlene Castle. So we have two guests this evening that's going to talk to us about what they do. And, you know, so this is going to be interesting. So welcome both of you guys. I'm glad to have you on the show. So I want to know some things about yourself. I want to know some things that you do. And also, I want you guys to start your presentation about tonight's topic, which is homelessness and mental health / substance use. All right, so we're going to start with Alexis. Alexis, go ahead and take over for us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Again, my name is Alexis Kelly. I'm a licensed independent social worker that's in DC currently with 6 years of mental health, individual therapy, family therapy background, who's recently transitioned to hospital social work. And so, and I cover the emergency department. And so I come with hopefully a good wealth of knowledge and experience that I've acquired, but we want today's discussion to be open based on what you all experiences have been, maybe serving this unique population and bring about some discussion towards ideally what's needed to create more positive change for these particular individuals. So I invited my dear friend from undergrad. So we're about 10 plus years strong in friendship, Ms. Charlene Castle, who works primarily in the housing of homeless individuals background. And so we often dialogue pretty frequently about the perils experienced with working with homeless individuals and those who may be affected by mental illness and or substance use. So Charlene, do you want to take a minute to explain your background?
Yes. Thank you guys so much for having us. Very happy to be here. And like Alexa said, we have dialogue about this all the time, and we don't always agree. So I think it'll be fruitful today. We do a lot of stuff, but we're really excited to field your questions and talk more about this topic that I know both of us care about a lot. So like Alexa said, I'm Charlene Castle, and I work right now for a company called JDOT, which is based out of DC, and we work on developing and operating housing for people who have experienced homelessness. So the model is called permanent supportive housing. We have it all across the US. I know there's lots in California too. And it just means it's permanent housing specifically for this population of folks who have experienced homelessness. And it's paired along with supportive services. So anyone who moves into this type of housing has a social worker or a case manager to work with them to help them maintain their housing stability. So all of my focus in DC is on trying to build more apartment buildings that serve this population, and then working with other partners, including like housing developers, nonprofits, social workers, other community partners, to to have that be successful, right? And to make sure that that folks both are housed and are able to stay housed, because that's often, people will frequently re-experience homelessness even after they have found housing. A little bit on my background, like Alexa said, we went to undergrad together at San Diego State. And during the time that I was in San Diego, I volunteered at a women's shelter there. So that's the bulk of my homelessness experience in California is there. And then my mom also worked in this field. So it's something that I've very much grown up with. And then I went to grad school, got my master's in public administration, and then moved to DC and started this job. So the bulk of my knowledge and expertise about this topic is pretty DC based, which has some unique characteristics, but I think, and you know, Alexis will talk about this a little bit as well. I think a lot of what we see here is mirrored nationally. It varies a little bit from state to state, but yeah, a lot of it is pretty similar across borders. So it's a little about me.
Perfect. Oh. Mr. Rajiki, you're unmuted. Do you want us to go ahead and get started?
Oh, excuse me. You know, I have a question for you guys. Now, I don't know if you wanted to say some more, Alexis, before I ask you this question.
Go ahead.
So I have a question for you and Charlene. Now, you know, growing up and, you know, and being a citizen of the United States, I got to say that the United States has a large part in causing a lot of issues for individuals. Mm-hmm. What do you guys, both of you, think about prevention? What is being done about preventing people? What is this nation doing to prevent people from becoming homeless? You know what I'm saying? What are we doing as a nation to prevent these things from happening? Because it seems like we cause more problems than we solve. So you guys take a shot at that.
Let's see. So I'll just kick it off, and then I have to stop myself and I'll let Charlene go in, because like I said, we spent hours talking about this material. And so when it went to answer your question in short, I think there are a lot of efforts made to try to support programs and prevention, early intervention. However, the amount of funding provided to these programs to help with prevention is dismal. So it affects the ability to help reduce the rates of homelessness when there's not enough money to support the prevention programs in of itself. And then the programs that do provide the services for homeless individuals don't also have the money either to help those who are actively homeless. So like you said, while America has caused a lot of problems, they don't want to pay for some of these solutions. They don't want to do it. The same way we know that is because when COVID came, money was being made to help get people out of dire need. Money came out of nowhere, seemingly, when it came to the stimulus. People are like, where is this money coming from? This is the same money people have been asking for decades to help reduce this homeless problem. So if money can come overnight, essentially, money was there all along, is the theory. But money is not being funneled to this program. So there again, we will talk a little bit about the prevention efforts that are being made to help support those who may be on the brink of homelessness. But again, the answer in short is, where's the money?
Okay.
Where's the money? Some of the material that I found was that the issues folks are facing requires institutional measures, policymakers making efforts to help with the complex social problem of homelessness. To what Charlene and I often discuss is that housing someone isn't the issue. We can put you in a room, but how do we address the fact that you have perhaps psychological, emotional, traumatic, neglectful, mental health, substance use, financial, employment, criminal backgrounds. That's one individual. We put you in the house. But what do we do to address all those multifaceted needs of that individual to make them successful in the house? One of the articles mentioned that 20 to 25% of individuals that are experiencing homelessness have a mental illness compared to 6% of the population. Conversely, majority of those who are homeless don't have a mental illness. So while there's a quarter of those that do, so 20-25%, most actually don't. But there are what we see, which are we call street homeless or unsheltered homeless. So the public sees the unsheltered homeless, and well, if you're not in the field, it's easier to conceptualize, oh my gosh, we have to get these very sick, ill people off the street and put them in a house. There's statistics that show there's agencies that work specifically on counting. We call them, like, you know, they call them like these, the counts of who is homeless. And they break it down for those who are, again, unsheltered homeless, sheltered homeless, chronically homeless, veteran homeless. So there's just a lot more to the story than what the media or what one visually can see. And we recognize that race, gender, ethnicity is going to impact those more significantly. And another statistic showed that many Americans are one paycheck away from homelessness. And these are working people. These are working people who seemingly are not having as many of the multifaceted struggles that I mentioned about those who are experiencing homeless, but they're still one paycheck away. So how does that make them different than you and me? And so that's where Charlene and I talk about, okay, what more can we be doing to help support these individuals? And I'll let Charlene speak to the type of services that are being provided to those who are housed in the permanent supportive housing programs.
Thanks, Alexis. I also want to circle back to the original question real quick, because the first thing that popped into my head when you said, like, what are we doing is not enough, right? Which is consistent with everything that Alexis just said. And like you said, I think homelessness is very much a downstream problem, right? The folks that I'm working with every day, have been failed by most of the other systems, right? And I think that there is, like Alexa said, no easy, like, oh, you're going to put them in a house and then it'll be fine. If we got folks into housing as soon as they started experiencing homelessness and before they dealt with the trauma of that, maybe that would be a little bit more true. But, you know, we're often working with folks who have all of these other coexisting things happening and who have already, you know, not been treated well by the education system, who have been subject to systemic racism in all of these different facets of our society, who aren't being paid a minimum wage, right? Or are getting minimum wage, which we know has not kept pace with housing costs. One of the more, like, most influential things I remember hearing in, like, one of the public meetings I was at in DC was a guy who had experienced homelessness saying, you know, like, 15 years ago, my friends who were working at McDonald's could afford their own place, and now they can't, right? Because they haven't kept pace. And so I think that the government created the problem with its policies, right? Like, the government has a lot of impact over minimum wage and whether we provide free health care and whether people get education. And I think, and not to mention, like, actual, like, housing policy and segregation and redlining and, you know, excluding certain groups, particularly Black Americans, from the housing market. You know, that's a huge chunk of it too. But it's when you combine all of the systems together, I think it paints a really clear picture that, like, our government has failed a huge swath of the population in this. And like Alexis said, there's a lot more people who are getting a lot closer to that line, right? I think that we used to think of homelessness a little bit more as, like, oh, that's something that, like, only people who really have a lot of issues or really, you know, aren't doing what they need to be doing, that's what happens to them. And we're seeing for the first time, like, more and more people become homeless for the first time after the age of 55, who had never experienced homelessness before because they had been working, you know, a minimum wage job, living paycheck to paycheck, and then they get a medical bill that puts them over the edge. And I think that that is shedding a different light on the issue as a whole, and really, I think, lends itself to showing, like, I think our government needs to do something about this, both on the local level and the federal level. And that's not just about housing, it's about all of the systems combined.
Okay, we have some new people here. So I want to hear, because we hear from, you know, our regular panelists all the time. So I want to get some other people's take on that. Sue, can you unmute, please? Sue? Okay, let's go to Naomi. Naomi?
Yes. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Do you want to talk about, did you hear what the question was?
I did hear your question. So do you want me to like add my thoughts or present another question?
Yes, please, if you would like.
I think that Charlene and Alexis did a really good job of kind of identifying a lot of the challenges. I think that our country definitely, and our federal, I think state governments, each like state government handles homelessness differently. And I think that like there are many different problems that each state faces, which is a part of that. But I think it boils down to a lot of like classism. So I think that to continue like our capitalistic type of society, it's going to be important to keep folks impoverished and living check to check. So I think there's a lot of policy issues that we need to address. So those are my inputs right now. I definitely want to comment more, but you caught me off guard. I'll be ready next time.
No, you're good. Thanks a lot for that. So we're going to go to Miss Sandra. Miss Sandra?
Okay. Hey, guys.
Hi.
I agree with Charlene and Alexis, of course. Alexis really broke it down where I didn't think about the different types of homelessness, because she's right. You know, on the media, they always show the people on the street, in the tents, in the RVs, on the park, you know, but that is true. There are people who are one paycheck away. There are people who are actually housed. There are actually people who are in programs. But one thing about that I see about mental health personally, I have friends whose family members were labeled either bipolar, schizophrenic, major depression. I deal with that personally in my own family. So what I have learned, though, is it's so much red tape to get the individual the assistance they need. That's one thing about the mental health issue that we have. You know, you may can get the individual into therapy, but the therapy may be 30 days away, or it may be 2 months away, because their therapist are overwhelmed or overloaded, and they, you know, the appointments are 3 months away when the person is having major issues right now. You know, it's like for mental health, there's not a lot of right now moments. It's like, okay, I need a house right now. So they go to the mental, you know, for assistance. And it's like, well, we can't help you right now. You know, I need therapy right now. Well, you better call 911 and do a 5150, because that's the only way you're going to get some help. So those are some issues that I see that are issue. And the other thing I see is, there are a lot of people who there are programs out there, especially like, for example, on Skid Row. There's a lot of programs where if they.
Oh, you accidentally muted, Auntie.
Yeah. All that. But when it's time to go to the support group or follow the rules, you know, the people are like, I don't want to follow the rules. I just want to eat and I want to sleep. So a lot of people don't want to do the program. And that's another issue. And another thing Alexis said was that a lot of people on the street are really not mental don't have any mental health issues, you know, which I never thought about. But I also believe, and I'm sure Alexis and Charlene can break this down more. I feel that if you end up on the street and you're homeless, the life of being on that street, if you're not mentally ill before then, I think you're going to have some mental illness as you continue to live on the street. I don't think people sleep well on the street. I don't think people, I think there's a lot of rape going on, a lot of people stealing people's stuff. You know, so I really feel that if you stay on the street long enough, I think there will be some mental health issues that are just going to come along with just being in that life. So, but I'm like everyone else, I'm excited to be here and excited to hear what they have to say, because it's very great information so far.
Okay, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. All right, well, Linda Shorter, can you unmute, please?
Yes, I can.
How you doing? Were you able to get the question that was posed to the panel?
No, I didn't. If you please.
Okay, so let me repeat it. And this is like an observation of mine. I said it seems like the United States, the government, the people that are in charge, sort of cause more problems than they fix. So we were talking about what is being done to prevent homelessness. And then we started with that. So would you like to comment?
And I only comment I can say is I agree totally 100% of what you're saying. And my concern is, and I came in at the tail end of it, but my concern is about the children. And I heard you talking about mental health. What are we doing about the children, our youth, with homelessness?
Yes.
So are there programs already in place for them?
Mm-hmm. And let me see if I can find, I found material about that. Is that overwhelming majority of folks, I'll find the statistic here in just a second, but I was reading it earlier today. Overwhelming majority of folks will receive housing much faster than family. Okay. Undoubtedly, families are going to receive more services, more expeditious services, and accessibility to services and access to housing much faster compared to individuals who are homeless.
And I can say that that's reflected in DC too. In the past couple of years, we've seen huge reductions in family homelessness in DC because they're always counted separately, like Alexis said. And we only have, I think as of last year, there were only 6 unaccompanied minors. Most children who were experiencing homelessness were part of the family unit. And in that same period, we've seen individual homelessness go up. So there's definitely directed resources towards families, but it certainly still exists. And I think that's a huge issue, of course.
Okay. Anything else, Linda?
No, I was just going to comment what she just said. It was 6 individual children who were minors who were unaccompanied, correct? So what happened to them?
So Linda, because you didn't get the meeting. So Alexis and I both work in DC. So I'm speaking to DC specifically because those are the stats that I know best. But they do a point in time count every year where they count every single person experiencing homelessness, and they counted 6 unaccompanied minors. So that usually means like teenagers who either are emancipated from their parents or otherwise not part of a family unit. And we have very targeted services for them. So there are separate homeless services providers who only work with those youth. Those youth are also much more likely to be part of the LGBTQ community in our experience, and that often results in them separating from their family unit. And in terms of what happens to them, I don't work specifically in that part, so I can't say for certain, except that there are separate services for them, often separate shelters. And I'm sure that some of them, you know, end up sleeping on the streets or couch surfing with friends. Yeah, but because it's probably not safe for them to be in, you know, the adult shelters that we have here. Are those targeted services and whether they use those or not?
Probably a different part of the country. I'm in Florida, but I know federally we have the Department of Family and Children Services all over the country. So that's why I was asking, not specifically for DC area, but throughout the country.
Yeah, and I can't speak to that part as much, except that I'm sure that they're involved with all of the local governments. In my experience, most homeless service response tends to be pretty local government implemented, but they're always getting funding and oversight from the federal agencies. So I would imagine in most places it's probably something similar where they're overseen by that, but you have specific services on the local level targeted towards youth.
Correct. Thank you.
Yeah. And I just wanted to highlight real quickly what Ms. Sandra was saying about the mental health accessibility piece of it. So some of the stats I have is over 60% of youth with major depression do not receive any mental health treatment. Even in states with the greatest access, nearly one in three are going without treatment. And even those among the severe depression, youth who have severe depression who do receive treatment, only 27% will receive this consistent care that she mentioned. In states with the least access, only 12% receive consistent care. And about 950, this is for the US, 950,000 youth don't have, for that have private insurance, don't have the mental health coverage. So, so there's, like I said, if there's, once you go one direction, then you're going to go about five steps back for one area, three steps forward, another area, 10 steps back or something. So it all, and again, we're talking about one singular individual, depending on the chief complaint, the chief need, that can get you either forward or further back than where you are to begin with.
Wow.
And especially depending on what system you're coming from.
Yeah, and what state you're in. And to that same point, Sandra, you said something else that's really important that Alexis and I were talking about earlier when we were kind of doing our pre-call chat, which is homelessness is absolutely, like, it can be a result of trauma and mental health, and it is absolutely a cause too. Because like you said, if you come in and you were like doing okay and you just, you know, had that medical bill or lost your job, and but you were otherwise doing fine, and then you're sleeping on the street or in a shelter for however long, that absolutely can make it much harder to stabilize afterwards because of the trauma that you experienced during that time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you. Lisa? Lisa?
Hi, everybody. I'm driving, so if I got a little loud here. I would just like to say one of the things that I think I have been able to see recently that has just really alarmed me is the rate of suicide with younger adults. And it is just so upsetting to me and disappointing to me that we're losing some young adults to suicide when that's never really been an issue before. And I'm not talking about, you know, people that are upset. I mean, I'm talking about African-American young people who never ever had a history of doing that type of stuff before. And I just like to know if that's something that, Alexis, I don't know if you could speak on it or Charlene, but what, where do you see that at, and why is it so prevalent now? I realize we're out of COVID and that type of thing, but is there some other factors that maybe you could weigh in on?
I mean, what I have here is that this is from the Mental Health of America statistics. Suicidal ideation continues to increase amongst adults. 4.58%, so roughly about 4.5% of adults report having serious thoughts on suicide, which is an increase of 664,000 people from last year's data. The national rate of suicide ideation among adults has increased every year since 2011 and 2012. This was a larger increase than seen in last year's report and is a concerning trend going into the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think that most of the statistics we have is 2020 because they said they had such a difficult time being able to get accurate statistics with COVID happening. And they said that a lot of times the greatest risk of severe depression, and for folks, severe depression or clinical depression, part of the symptomatology can include suicidal ideation. They said multiracial youth are at the greatest risk right now of severe depression. That's what I thought was very interesting, is that they're saying that folks who have more than one race are more likely to experience a mental illness of depression. And so there is an increase in the suicidal ideation. I need to get the statistics on how many folks are completing suicidal acts, but certainly there is that increase. And I just want to mention too, along those lines of mental health, again, less than 1% of the population is schizophrenic or have schizophrenia. Majority of folks who are experiencing mental illness are actually experiencing anxiety disorder. That's going to be about 30%. I believe for PTSD is about 5% of the population. Bipolar disorder, I believe it was 3%. I read it earlier this morning. Depression, maybe about 8%. But more or less, it's going to be anxiety disorder. The news suggests to you that it's schizophrenia and bipolar disorder running rampant. And so for me, as a mental health provider, it can be really frustrating because folks are coming in thinking they have schizophrenia. I'm like, you don't have, it's such a small subset of the population. And you see folks acting crazy out in the streets. It could be a number of different reasons why. If you go without regular food and water, I believe there is a level of delirium that can set in. And if you exacerbate that with drug use, which we know is frequent to cope with being on a street, not to say that because they were drug addicts before, they now are homeless from it. But if they're coping using substances while being homeless, dealing with the trauma, neglect, the fighting, all those different things, Of course, we're going to see some elements of acute mental problems. But even when we think about mental health issues, the news doesn't I don't feel accurately display what is the primary diagnosis many are experiencing. And this is where COVID really shed light on. A lot of people struggle with depression. It is very, very common. A lot of people struggle with anxiety. But that doesn't equate to you being bipolar because you have a mood imbalance every now and again. Bipolar disorder is a very, very extreme chronic mental illness. Schizophrenia is a very extreme chronic mental illness, and yet it can be tossed around so flippantly. And I'm just like, do you know what you're saying? And let us not forget about African-Americans, Black folks very seldom like to seek mental health services because we recognize that there are biases or lack of accessibility. So when they do finally come in for services, we also recognize, just like there's suicidal ideation, that might be a symptom of depression. Irritability is a symptom of depression. But also when we think about PTSD, which is a large part of the population for Black folks particularly, there is going to be elements of their personality that might shift how one would be normally presented if they had not gone through those perils. And so our knowledge base and being able to provide the accurate and appropriate services is suffering severely, especially those now that I'm in a hospital who seek mental health treatment through emergency departments, where they might not be equipped to handle all those mental health issues. Because if you're coming in, there's many times where folks have come into a hospital saying one thing, like, you know what? They say, how's your sleep? An older Black male said the TV was watching me, which really means that he was asleep and the TV was on. They took that as him believing that the TV was watching him, and they gave him an antipsychotic. That happens very often. So the lack of knowledge base on appropriately treating mental health, accurately identifying suicidal risk factors, appropriately providing the support in the now, when recognizing that homelessness, and especially those who are experiencing chronic homelessness, it will take more time than the immediate to provide that accurate and appropriate support to get them the right services. There's so many different facets to it. And so I just wanted to kind of shed light on, there is no quick fix and there is no one true scenario. We're dealing with human lives, with human experiences, and coming from all different pathways. And that requires a lot of attention. And I'm not quite sure the United States is ready to deal with that, because I think that would have to put into question some of their own practices that got them there in the first place. And some people's hands are in pockets that I think we can't really necessarily touch yet. So we're not going to necessarily always get the answers that we need.
That was excellent. That
thank you, Lexi.
Thank God. You know, Lexi, you need to speak. You and Charlene, you need to speak in at schools and to students and things, because what you just said is so important for them to hear, because you have so many young people who are being mislabeled. And, you know, and the medical, especially being African American, I'm sorry, Black and brown, any disparities, you're going to have lacking medical service. And that's just what it is. You know, I think before when I was on this show, I talked about how Black and brown people are being treated in healthcare. There's no culture of humility. So, you know, you have somebody just coming in saying, you know, I can't sleep, I'm having issues. Okay, you're bipolar. Here's some Zoloft, here's some Xanax, and you go on your way. So you have these people believing, you know, they just take these labels. I'm bipolar. Therefore, you know, what's happening to me, I can't do anything better about because I'm bipolar. And this is, and it's really sad that people are going through that. And like Lisa was saying about the suicide rate, I totally agree, Lisa, because I tell you, I'm 57 years old. When I was Lexi's age and in my 20s and 30s, I may have known one person to kill themselves. Now I just hear it every day. And it doesn't matter if you're Regina King's son or if you're a regular Joe in South LA's daughter, you know, they kill themselves. I think social media has a lot to do with it. I think these phones and the things, these websites that they're on has a lot to do with it, as well as depression and the things they're going with. But Lexi, I'm telling you, you hit it on the head right there. Excellent commentary. Excellent.
Okay, now we want to hear from some other people, because we have a nice large crowd tonight. This is large for us. So let's go to Brother Hembrick. Hembrick, you want to chime in? You're on mute, if you could hear me. Okay, let's go to Professor Rob. We'll come back later. Professor Rob?
Yeah, Abani Ghani, everyone. Appreciate what's been said, if I understand correctly. A lot of positive information. You know, when you start dealing with mental illness and homelessness, as some people think they go hand in hand, but it don't necessarily go hand in hand. There is a lot of challenges why you have homelessness. And there's a lot of reasons why some people have different degrees of mental challenges. And so it depends upon, you know, diagnosing each one. But at the same time, the society tries to treat them all the same, like one shoe fit all. And that's not the way it goes, because at one time, one of the biggest public housing was, well, still, one of the biggest public housing is the county jails and the prison. That right there could, releasing people after years of incarceration, and they come out and face a different world, or the loved ones aren't there, that could cause a lot of issues. Second, you have people that come home from the service, and they, you know, they were expecting, you know, when in combat in either in Afghanistan or in Iraq or right now in Ukraine or whatever, they come back and they have a lot of challenges with regards to facing life. And after they see all the death and the activities that go with war, the total annihilation of people, seeing parts of bodies, parts walking through those type of things, and then killing people yourself, and so that caused a lot of issues. But when we get down to America, as has been rightly said, they don't have a czar of mental illness or a czar of homelessness, and that builds a national approach to the study and to the solutions and developing the various agencies. I know in Watts, we used to have the Watts Mental Health Center. And then we had, because they wanted to address the drug problems and that. But there are a lot of people that, for whatever reason, you know, capitalism, as Sandra and Charlotte and Alexis was saying, played the part in it because of the greed and selfishness of people with mental, with resources they don't share. They want more. People with money want more money. People with power want more power. And you don't have that network of caring about people. I mean, you walk past mental illness or homelessness, even the churches, the mega churches that went from the gospel of service and caring to the gospel of prosperity, trying to, you know, make more money. They lock their doors instead of opening their parking lots or doors for people to park and live or even going into that. They'd rather open up a child care center and get a faith-based money rather than open up a church and a service. People, they every now and then they have a food giveaway because they go to a food bank and get the food. It's not like they're picking up offerings and buying the food themselves, most churches. Then you have the issue of people living in cars now. They're not, you know, and they're living in vans and they car and they're living in SUVs, not SUVs, you know, recreation vehicles. I mean, we have them all up and down the street in Los Angeles. I mean, people go find an old recreation vehicle and convert it into a house and park it on the corner. And it become a village, you know. And some of the homeless camps and homeless cities and tent cities, they get organized. And they develop their own police, their own, day watch, night watchmen. And then they figure out a way to get electricity or figure out the way to, even if it's through batteries or whatever. It's different. And you'd be worried about because you say the weather changed. How you gonna keep living like that? But still, you know, then you got the foster homes, as Alexis and Charlene were saying, the population of young people. Because, you know, once people get 18, many foster parents let them go. But they didn't really put the time in and make sure they got a vocational skill or academically orientated, and that makes a lot of the people that are not living in with their families are living with. They weren't living with their families at all. They were living with a foster parent. And so then the foster parents say, I got to make room for another kid. And the younger the one, the best one, because they could keep them longer. And some of the, there's no test or evaluation of foster parents. You know, like how many kids you had that went to jail? How many kids you had that end up running away or going on drugs? They just give them another kid and another kid, even though they're failing. And that contributes to the youth anxiety and frustration, you know. And, you know, there's so many things that, that contributes to the both of the mental illness. And I just think, like you said, they can find billions of dollars to go to war. They can find billions of dollars to deal with the multitude of the problem because they created it by when governments say, hey, it costs too much. They used to have mental institutions. In California, Reagan got them out, but he ended up going crazy himself, you know. And but the point is that they don't have places where you can't, like if I have a son or a daughter or a relative with serious mental issues, I can't go and sign them in, you know, and say, hey, you need to put them, I can't go and there's no place I can go put them. Now, rich people, they can pay for their kids to go to somewhere in Malibu or somewhere else. But most poor people, you know, they want you to pay to send them to a mental health center on mental health. Now, they got some public ones, but at the same time, they try to cut their budget, and, you know, it's almost like a jail, and all they do is give them medication, you know, open your mouth and throw a pill in it, and tell you, keep taking your meds to keep you calm, like you're a zoo animal, and they will got to keep you sedated, keep you from, you know, acting wild. So, you know, it's a lot of issues that's involved here. And then at the same time, there are certain people that volunteer to say, hey, look, I'm going to live this life until I can get it together. Because in California, a two-bedroom apartment, you know, you're talking about almost $2,500 a month. And that's rough if you don't have no job. And that's Black people. Racism, oppression, psychoneurosis, discrimination. You trying to get it together, but every time you try to get a job, you're not bilingual, especially in California. You can't get hired, you know. And then you know, if slavery was still here, we'd be working. But if it ain't about free labor, you know, that'd be an issue. So the analysis that you're giving is so right on from a clinical standpoint and professional standpoint. But we got a lot of unprofessional and unclinical issues we have to deal with. Some are politics and some are design, as you said rightly. In order to have rich, you got to have poor. In order for some people to feel blessed, you have to see people that are suffering. And then you say, oh, I'm blessed to have what I have. So that's all I have to say. I just want to say to each speaker, and including those that made comments, everything has been excellent. And I think this is one good learning session. And just hope we continue to strive and work toward trying to come up with a national resources, enough resources, because each region, as you have said, each state has its different laws, treatments, and policies. So you need a national and federal approach, because it's all over. That's all around.
Thanks a lot, Professor Rao. Peter, can you unmute?
Hey, good evening, everyone. I've been listening to the discussion. I was in my car and then jumped on my computer, finally made it home in time. You know, I was thinking about three things that we've been dealing with when we're talking about mental illness and homelessness. And the first thing you always try to look at is, I always look at, where are we focused? We've never made this on the same level as a medical condition. We take a look at somebody who has diabetes and we say, hey, here's a prescription. Here's what we do. Here's how we treat it. We know what's going on. But when we look at mental illness, it seems to take a second or third tier. We don't prioritize it as an illness, period, the way it should be prioritized. Number two is, we've never taken the time to really look at the long-term effects of things that we do that contribute to mental illness and homelessness. We are very short-sighted. It's almost like society has gotten to a point where we can only see up to the tip of our nose and we can't look at the unforeseen, which always are foreseen if you would take a look at it. You know, back in the 1950s, Eisenhower signed the Interstate Commerce Act. And what he did was he decided we needed to have a system of roads so we could move commerce back and forth. That was the whole point of the interstate highway system. But that was somebody who had vision of looking at something 50 years in the future. When we're dealing with mental illness or homelessness, we don't have a plan for 50 years in the future. If we're dealing with something now, guess when we're going to start actually solving something? It's going to be long since I'm in the ground or burned up because we haven't made it a priority. But the other issue that I think is coming out, and I think Ra kind of touched on this too, and I'm going to just take it to this part. Until it starts impacting the vast majority of the comfortable population, it will always remain a secondary issue. Until enough people are impacted in the nice, safe neighborhoods that they can afford to move into, And then when they start screaming loud enough, then maybe you'll get some more immediate action. But as long as we're all pretty fat, comfortable, and out of the and out of sight, out of mind, we're not going to see the same level of action that we would see the way we mobilized on COVID, which is a gigantic ass cold, excuse my French. And for the vast majority, it's 99.9%. But we mobilized that in less than 3 or 4 months and got that all together and did this whole thing. We have all this series of regulations and laws that you have to follow in terms of testing here, testing there, you stay home from work for 5 days, stay off for 10 days, quarantine, all that stuff. We don't have that kind of laser focus on mental illness because it has not been a priority to us. And I remember something, and I don't know if my wife mentioned this, but we were at a breakfast about 5-6 years ago. We had a pastor there, and she was speaking specifically to the African-American crowd and said, you know what, every African-American in this country needs to be in therapy because we have been operating under a system of high stress, low reward, broken promises, and keep having hope for something that just doesn't materialize. And after a while, you stop wondering about, is this hope even real? I remember during the pandemic, I believe it was Doc, the former coach of the Clippers. And he said something that I've never forgotten. I said, it's really interesting he said this. He said, it's amazing that we love a country that does not love us back. And you get to a point where you get tired of giving out and you don't see any reward, or your reward is a tent on the street and you're moved out of the way when there's dignitaries coming. Because you know what happens when we have some sort of summit or some sort of conference like we just had in downtown LA, all of a sudden Figueroa was beautiful. Everything looked beautiful. We could move them all out the way when the priority is enough for the comfortable folks to want to have a good picture to present. But how about have a good picture to present 365 days a year and make it a priority to solve a problem rather than keep sweeping it under the rug? Because eventually we're going to trip over the hump in the rug and we're going to have to deal with it. And when we deal with it, it is not going to be in a way that we're going to be able to solve it with a level of smoothness and a level of, it's going to be violent. It's going to be shocking. It's going to be something where if we had dealt with this 30, 40 years ago, like Ross said, talk about where Reagan defunded the mental health institution. In fact, I was coming back from Northern California a few weeks ago and decided to drive through Cal State Channel Islands, which used to be Camarillo State Hospital, where we could get, where you had public treatment. We left it to the states. The states didn't make it a priority. It's just not a priority. And we can't always just rely on the goodness of people to constantly volunteer. We need, like Ross said, we need a national person, the same cabinet type level person where we have a health and human services cabinet level person or an attorney or a surgeon general. We need a surgeon general for mental health. It is an absolute pandemic that's been going on for 50 years. It's been ignored. And again, until it gets ugly, we're not going to prioritize it. That's all I have to say.
Wow, that was a mouthful. Excellent, Peter. I appreciate that. Now, Alexis and Charlene, is there something else you want to bring forth where we could discuss it? Or because I know it's getting late in D.C. It's already late. So, you know, it's there because we've been going for about an hour and we had a lot of great input. Is there something else that you would like to speak about when it comes to this topic?
Yeah, so I think what I will say in terms of my recent experience working full time with the emergency department of the hospital, George Washington University Hospital, I'll say that what I'm having to have patients quickly recognize is that, and also the medical providers, is that point number one being the hospital is not a Disneyland experience. So while you want an ideal outcome, that's sometimes not feasible in the immediate. we're talking about an acute situation, and sometimes we only have acute solutions, which means it's short term. It's not going to be perfect. This is not the best that we can do, but this is the best that we can offer right now. And so folks come in with long-term chronic issues, and they want those solutions right then. They're here and they're in the hospital, they're in an emergency department, and they want help because they finally have gotten to the point where they've had it. They're at their limit. And I have to tell them, the best I can probably offer you right now is a homeless shelter. And those same people I have to offer homeless shelter services to are the same people who are here from the homeless shelter when they got punched in the face and their teeth knocked out. So they're in the ED because they were at the homeless shelter, they were assaulted at the homeless shelter, robbed, and now they're here at the emergency department for looking for help. But the only help I can offer from the hospital is the homeless shelter. And they look at me like, what do you mean? I said, I know, but that's it. That's what we have. That's the option. There is no hotel that we can send you to. There's no program that can take you today and put you somewhere tomorrow. This is it. And so on the one hand, we have that lived experience for folks coming in every day in the ED, that happens every day. And then secondly, as much as we have these medical providers, these MDs providing this service to the folks, insurance companies run the hospital. So you can receive the best medical advice all you want with the best medical prescription. But if your insurance doesn't approve it, you're not going to get it. So it's similarly to like income. You're working, but you're working only at minimum wage. You're unlikely to afford some of the things that others would be able to with the house. And that's just the end of the story. Unless you work two or three jobs, you are not going to qualify. And rest assured, once you meet over a very small threshold of minimum wage, you are not going to be eligible for low-income services because you're not poor enough. So either you're destitute or you can work, but you can't be both. And if you are both, you can knock off half of what you think you might be eligible for. And so we experience that often as well. They're saying, hey, I have a little something, but this is not enough. And I say, in the eyes of the government, you have more than enough to be sufficient. And it's not enough. But I think too, to my last point, like I was mentioning before, the hands are in different pockets. You know, I live in Navy Yard of DC, which is completely gentrified. If you go over the bridge a mile away, just 1 mile, just whoop, I used to work over the bridge, it looks horrible, absolutely horrible. And that's called Southeast DC. It is run down, it is old, it is dirty. Nothing about it is new. They're just now building new things around there. But it's pushing people out that have been there long term, and it's predominantly a Black area. If you come over here, it's young white folks over here. And so the fact of the matter is that where is the money at? Because the money is what's talking. So insurance companies are talking because they have the money. These developers are talking. And Charlene can speak to the fact, and we'll conclude with this, that there are a lot of the buildings, a lot of new high rises that I'm surrounded by. They'll advertise in their contracts a certain percentage of those units should be for what is it considered, low income, Char? Low income tenancy. They might start the contract with, oh, we'll have, I'm just throwing a number. We'll have 30 beds available for unit. We'll have 30 units for low income. By the time that folks start filling in those spaces, Charlene has told me it's down to maybe a handful of units. The rest are for folks who can afford those 2,000 and up rates. And there's a reason for that, because the demographics look great. The optics look really good around here. There's restaurants, there's bars, there's just thriving. I told you to go 1 mile away, there's guns, shots all the time. 1 mile. So there is, again, where is the money and who's controlling the money? That's what will help make this a priority, like as Uncle Peter mentioned. It's like I said, multifaceted, and I think we all have touched on those points. So I'll just conclude by saying that. Charlene, do you have any closing remarks?
Nothing that hasn't been said in different words, but I'll try to say it in different words real quick and like build on. I mean, I think that, everything that everyone has said is very on point. There's a really good book that I recommend called Winners Take All, that if you haven't read it, it deals a lot with a lot of what we're talking about. And there's a phrase in there where he says something to the effect of like, we've created this culture of scarcity, and there isn't actual scarcity. There's an abundance. It's just an inaccessible abundance. And so I think like Alexis was talking about with like folks coming into the hospital and saying, I need X, Y, and Z. If our government wanted to provide those things, we could, right? We saw that with COVID. Suddenly the money is there. But we have to create all of these barriers for people to get what they need, because we refuse to fund it because we don't think it's important. And to Peter's point, when it starts to affect the masses, which I think eventually a lot of this stuff will, like I said, we're seeing more folks become homeless for the first time as seniors, which has never happened before. Then people will start to care more. But until then, I think it's really hard. So, for example, like in the work that I do, you cannot access any type of housing, or you're not even considered chronically homeless in DC. And this is true for, this is like a national rule that HUD set, until you have experienced homelessness for a year, or if you have had four separate episodes of homelessness over 3 years. So if you come to a shelter in DC or like a homeless service provider and say, hey, I'm about to be put out of my house, I need help, I need housing, it's going to be go stay in the shelter for a year and then we'll be able to help you. And imagine what you're going to experience in that shelter for that year. And so I think that the core for me is we could be doing it if we wanted to, right? And it's, and until our government and the people in this country and the masses decide that this is important and we want to fund it and we want to fund mental health services and fund housing, it's not going to happen. And it hasn't always been this way. I mean, Professor Rahm, I appreciate that you brought in Reagan, because I mean, I wasn't alive then, so you guys could probably speak to this better than me, but I have looked at the numbers and like homelessness, like it exists now, did not exist before Reagan was president. And it has a lot to do with him shutting down the mental health services, and a lot to do with the trickle down economics, right? Which we know didn't trickle down. I think just going back to like, this is all preventable. It's all something that could be solved if and when the United States decides that it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. And don't be on supplemental security income. Don't be on SSI getting better, because you're gonna lose your income. So it's a whole cycle. You're on SSI for mental health issues. You're on Section 8 for housing. Don't start working, because they'll cut that income too. They'll cut that benefit. So it's a whole cycle, like you said, that scarcity chart. Mm-hmm. Don't get too good. Don't get much better, because then you don't need us anymore.
Right. Well, and it's nothing's gradual, right? We create all these income cliffs. It's not, hey, once you start to make a little more money, we'll pay a little less of your rent. It's like you said, it's like, oh, you got a job now? You make over this? I mean, in the stuff that I work on in DC, the 30% of the area median income is considered what's like very low income, which is, I think, $29,000. If you make 1 cent over $29,000, you no longer qualify for the housing that I work on. And I've seen people quit their jobs in order to get that housing, because what else are they going to do, right? Keep working and not be able to afford a place with their job. So the way that the system is built creates all these perverse incentives. And then some folks complain about people living off the system, and it's like, well, then change the system so that they can continue to work and have what they need. You know, the whole thing is broken.
Yeah, they're not going to change the system, because it's all orchestrated.
Yes.
So yep. Exactly.
All design.
Exactly.
It's by design, right?
You gotta rely on me. I get to tell you where you live. I get to decide what your income is. I get to decide what your degree of wealth, lack thereof, will be. You have to rely on me. That's America.
That's right.
Okay.
Well,
I just want to say this recipe right quick.
Okay.
You know, in California, gas is for a car is $6.50 average. Then you have rent that is off the chart. I mean, you know, then you have inflation that's going rapid nationally for food and things of this nature. So you're going to create a whole new set of homelessness, mental frustration when you can't feed your kids. Now, certain people, young people, can get Social Security by claiming mental illnesses, and some adults. But the point is that greed and envy drives people, you know, it drives them, you know. If your neighbor get a swimming pool, you want a pool with a jacuzzi. If your neighbor get a car, you want a car. And you know, you that's what drives the system, though. It's not designed for the help people. It's designed for people to drive. We go to college, and they spend more money paying us to help the people than giving us the money to help the people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and we got unions that pay, that make sure we get our mental health and get our health benefits and things of this nature. Poor people have to organize and become voters, you know, and one day that probably is going to happen, but that's all right.
Okay. Well, look, Charlene and Alexis, I want you to stay on for a second after we stop the recording. Now, what I want to add, oh, I think Lisa has something to say. Lisa?
No, I don't.
Okay. Okay, so now this is something I think I came up with. I don't know if I did or not. But if money is the value, the human is devalued. Mm-hmm. That's all I want to say. So now I want to thank everybody. I want to thank our guests, Lexis and Charlene. I'm glad you stayed up because you're 3 hours away to do this. It was excellent information, and I want to do it again. You know, maybe we can come up with some different subject matter, but this was excellent, and we need to have more forums like this so people can start looking at changing. We need to change this situation. And the only way we're going to change it is through organizing and coming up with solutions, because we know what the problem is. Now we need to come up with some solutions. But I want to thank everybody for coming. It was excellent. Now let me talk about what's coming up on tomorrow and next Wednesday. And then Professor Ra is going to tell us what's coming up for Monday. So on tomorrow, we have a special edition show. We have a guest that's in Ghana. So that should be very interesting. Her name is Priestess Victorious. And the topic is going to be the business that she has, which is Khalifa Consulting in Ghana. So that should be very excellent. So hopefully we get people to chime in. It's at 11 a.m. in the morning because she's in Ghana. It's a 7-hour difference. And then next Wednesday, we have a colleague of mine, and he's Dr. H, and the topic is why minorities need to invest their money. So those are the two shows that are coming up. And Professor Rob Mundy?
Yes, we have a brother, excellent brother, Professor Reginald Muhammad. He's out of Atlanta, and he's going to be discussing how to... why Black people deserve reparations. And he's formerly with the Nation of Islam. Strong, he just had a national conference on reparations. So we'll have him on Monday at 6 p.m.
Excellent. Okay, so I wanna thank everybody again. Each one teach one in Conscious Corner. Have a good evening.
All right, brother.